It's my pleasure to welcome you to the 2009 Chancellor's Human Rights Lecture. I'm delighted to see so many of you here this evening, reflecting, I think, the community's interest in human rights. I begin in our customary way by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, who are the traditional owners of the land on which this event will take place. The Chancellor's Human Rights Lecture was instituted by the then Chancellor, Dr. Faye Mars, in 2002. So this is the eighth consecutive human rights lecture that will be delivered, and it has become an important annual forum for public debate and discussion around critical issues of human rights within and outside the law. Speakers included Mary Robinson, the then President of Ireland, Zenana Gusmao, the Prime Minister of East Timor, Michael Kirby, Malcolm Fraser, the former Prime Minister, just to name a few. The critical importance of the recognition and preservation of human rights in the world, including our community, really cannot be overstated. As I've mentioned, the interest in human rights is understandably widespread and extends beyond the borders of the legal profession into all sectors of the community. One only has to pay some attention to media reports to see that that is the case. Now, you may ask, why is it that the university hosts lectures such as these? The answer is that this type of activity, this facilitating of debate with the community, is a critical plank in the strategy of development and progress. The strategy is based essentially on three intertwined core activities, namely research, teaching and learning, and knowledge transfer. This lecture and lectures of this type are an integral part of the university's knowledge transfer activity, through which it interacts with and contributes knowledge to the community, and importantly, learns from it. Thus, the university is proud to associate itself with such events as tonight's lecture and see public engagement and debate as one of the most important reasons for its existence. In keeping with this spirit of communications, there will be time for questions, I hope, and in that form we'll be asking the audience to participate in the topic that will be presented by Stephen Charles. But before introducing the speaker, I call on the Dean of the Law School, Professor James Hathaway, to put a little more detailed context to the importance of human rights at the university and generally. Professor Hathaway.
Thank you very much, Chancellor, and good evening, friends. The Chancellor has asked me to say a word about the influence of human rights within the university and more broadly. And of course, as I suspect everyone in this room, we are the chosen group tonight, shares the idea that human rights is something critically important. If you look around the university, human rights discourse is literally everywhere. Thinking only from my narrow optic at the law school, human rights is perhaps the single most favored area for doctoral research. Our students undertake internships with human rights organizations both domestically and internationally. We are very proud to sponsor one of the university breadth subjects, Human Rights and Global Justice, in which faculty from the law school join with their colleagues from history, political science, and medicine to teach the undergraduate populace of the university about the importance of human rights. And perhaps, I think, most intriguing of all this year, my colleague Gary Simpson has launched the Global Justice Studio, a place for conversation, exploration, activism, research, collaboration around ideas of world justice and human rights. The pervasiveness of human rights discourse at the university is, of course, mirrored in society more generally. It's one of those words, one of those expressions that everybody accepts as important. Who isn't in favor of human rights? It's a bit like not liking puppies or motherhood or something, right? We all love human rights. And yet, as one who's worked in the field for the last quarter century, I sometimes wonder if we actually understand what it is we say that we're in favor of when we advocate the importance of human rights. And it may be a good moment at the commencement of the lecture just to stand back and think for a moment about what we're actually saying when we acknowledge that there is such a thing as a human right. We're saying that whether you're black or white, male or female, rich or poor, there are certain inalienable entitlements that not only cannot be intruded upon, but in many cases, the state actually has an affirmative duty to ensure whoever you are, wherever you come from, whatever you believe. That's an extraordinary claim. Do we actually believe that human rights matter, or are they just a rhetorical claim? Political philosopher Hannah Arendt wrote, thinking about the emergence of human rights in the interwar period and the subsequent clear abrogation of those same norms during the Holocaust as follows. She said, "The conception of human rights broke down at the very moment when those who professed to believe in it were for the first time confronted with people who had indeed lost all other qualities and specific relationships, except that they were still human. The world found nothing sacred in the abstract nakedness of being human." And indeed, I fear that we remain very much in a similar position today. There are massive parts of the world in which the idea of human rights, at least as currency, not simply at the rhetorical level, but actually at the existential level, has no meaning whatever. We need only think about the complete exclusion of Uyghurs in China from all political rights, the exclusion of Roma or Gypsies throughout most of Europe from socioeconomic rights, the summary rounding up and detention of tens of thousands of Tamils in Sri Lanka simply on the grounds of their ethnicity by a government with which Australia is presently negotiating treaties that will preclude people from leaving that country. And sadly, even in Australia, while the level of disjuncture between the rhetoric and reality is not so grave, I wonder whether we actually do accept the notion that there are basic entitlements that inhere in absolutely everyone simply by virtue of being human. If we do, why do we continue to have debates suggesting straight marriage yes, gay marriage no? Refugees who manage to touch our territory get rights. Refugees just under our jurisdiction get none. So this lecture tonight is a very important point for the university and its annual calendar. It's a moment for us to take stock, to recommit ourselves to the actual practical importance of the notion of inalienable rights simply by virtue of being human. I'm delighted to be a part of this evening. I am thrilled that so many of you are here to share the evening with us, and I now call on the Chancellor to introduce tonight's guest speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean, and congratulations on pulling off what I regard as a coup, that's to say to enable students of your school to acquire another degree by studying in conjunction at universities like New York and Oxford. It's a great coup, and you'll be congratulated for it. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, the Honourable Stephen Charles QC, is well known to many of you. He's eminently suitable to speak on human rights, and may I briefly tell you why this is. There are, at least in my view, two Stephen Charleses, but they come together to clothe him with considerable authority to speak on human rights, and in particular the aspect of it that he will highlight so affirmatively and informatively in his paper this evening. One part of Stephen was formed largely through his activities that relate to progressing human rights. For example, during his student days here, where he was renowned, amongst other matters, for his impersonation of Tom Lehrer and singing songs to anyone with earshot or anyone else who would listen, such as poisoning pigeons in the park, and we will all go together when we go. He was active in seeking to overturn the White Australia policy. He was regarded by some as a radical. Difficult to believe today, but he was. As president of the university's SRC, which was regarded, I might say, in Australia as the association was regarded as a radical leader of the National Union of Australian University Students, Stephen strongly urged her to come out against the White Australia policy, notwithstanding that the Queensland delegate, you might not be surprised to hear, opposed it and even threatened secession from the national body. Ultimately, opposition to the policy was adopted by the national body. Stephen was also a member of the Immigration Reform Group, which in 1960 published a paper, White Australia Policy Control or Colour Bar. This group included radicals such as Sir James Gobbo, Professor Vincent Buckley of the English Department, and Professor Max Charlesworth of the Philosophy Department. Stephen also played a leading role in promoting equal opportunities for women at the Victorian Bar. He chaired from 1966 to 1968 its standing committee on this issue, playing a key role in the development in this area. He practiced, of course, what he preached, and he applied this course to his own home life, a matter that burst into the public arena with a full-page spread of coloured photographs of Stephen in the Australian Women's Weekly. In the context of an article, "These four men cook dinners for their wives." Now, consistently with these views in this area, Stephen and Jenny Charles adopted a Vietnamese boy and became foster parents to a girl from that ravaged country. Both became an integral part of their family, including the Charles' other two children, who I'm delighted to see here this evening. While doing all this, Stephen also made a major contribution to the development of the law in its various facets. That is the other aspect of him. At the university, he shared the Supreme Court prize, and whilst practising as a barrister, lectured here in mercantile law, property and conveyancing. Not really light subjects. He established a remarkable practice at the bar, appearing in a string of very important cases, including the Royal Commission into King Street Bridge and the Westgate Bridge and their failures, advising the Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, on the business affairs of the then Treasurer, Philip Lynch. He was counsel for ASIO in the Coombe Royal Commission and appeared for the Commonwealth in a number of states and a number of master builders' associations in proceedings to deregister the Builders Labourers Federation. He was also counsel assisting the Parliamentary Commission into the conduct of Mr. Justice Lionel Murphy and counsel for the South African Cricket Union and a number of Australian cricketers against the Australian Cricket Board. He was also counsel for SABHP in litigation and arbitration concerning royalties from the oil and gas from Bass Strait. Now, there are many others, of course, and I haven't got time to recount them. He became Queen's Counsel in 1975, was chairman of the Victorian Bar Council and president of the Australian Bar Association. And on 13 June 1995, he was one of three members of the bar of the newly constituted Court of Appeal, appointed directly from the bar. The other two were John Winnicky, who became its president, a very famous president, and Justice Frank Calloway. Stephen Charles' reasons were impeccable for his judgments, and he was followed in the English Court of Appeal and the High Court. Stephen lectured in a number of areas, more particularly since 2006, at this university and Monash University in a range of complex subjects, including comparative criminal law at the Prato campus of Monash University, where he also sharpened his knowledge in the Italian language. And he also lectured in corporate governance, the law of royal commissions and public inquiries and other complex areas. This is but a truncated version of the relevant aspects of the life of our speaker this evening. It gives me great pleasure to invite him to to deliver his paper on the Victorian Human Rights Act, a perspective from the European community.
Chancellor, Dean, ladies and gentlemen, I should say first, I don't know where you got all that nonsense from, Alex. And secondly, I should say thank you for coming. When they asked me to speak, I thought that might just be my family here. I want to say a few words first about the situation that's occurred in Italy, because it gives an indication how a charter like the Victorian Charter can have an impact on the way in which criminal procedure of a country is run, because the impact both in Italy and in France of the European Convention on Human Rights, quite akin to our Victorian Charter, has been enormous. Now, the Italian Code, having first been promulgated in the mid-19th century, was redrafted in 1930 in the days of Mussolini, and still strongly influenced by the Napoleonic Code. And it remained in force with minor amendments until it was dramatically changed in 1988. Now, under the 1930 Code, criminal proceedings were divided into two stages, the first involving the investigation of the offence and the second, the trial. The investigation was controlled by an investigating judge who oversaw the collection of evidence. The judge had extensive powers, including the summoning, examining, and if necessary, imprisoning of witnesses and the suspect. He could order searches, seizures, experiments, wiretapping. The principal aim of the investigating judge was not to assist a prosecution, but to ascertain the truth. And the result of the judge's researches was then enclosed in a dossier, and which would ultimately be made available to the trial judge or judges. The investigating judge usually commenced his investigations by questioning the suspect. And at first, the defence had no right, indeed was forbidden, to intervene in or even participate in the investigative stage, which was largely carried out in secret. After some amendments in 1970, the defence was given some right to challenge or to contradict. But the judge was then required to determine in that investigative stage whether, in the judge's view, there had been an offence committed, and if the judge took that view, the judge was then obliged to charge the suspect. There was no discretion in the matter. Prosecution was mandatory. It was written into the Italian constitution, and the purpose was to ensure equal treatment of everyone. So accordingly, the preliminary investigation was very much the central phase of the investigation. Since the handing of the dossier to the trial judge was usually followed at trial by little or no additional evidence being given. Witnesses frequently got into the witness box at trial, acknowledged that the statement contained in the dossier was their statement, and that was it. Confrontation and cross-examination at trial was possible, but frequently that was of no value, of no purpose, because the judge at trial, or judges, had in front of them the dossier that had been collected by the investigating judge and knew all its contents. The defendant and his counsel were entitled to put arguments and to call witnesses, but the questions until 1970 were not put by counsel. They were simply handed up to the trial judge to be put by the trial judge. Now, since the investigative stage took place shortly after the events giving rise to the charge, the result was that the trial usually took effect as little more than a repetition of the material collected by the investigative judge. And what was worse, is since the investigation took place shortly after the events had happened, the trial occurred frequently 10 years after this had happened. It was routine for perfectly ordinary criminal matters not to reach trial until 10 years or more after the events had occurred. This was something which was repeatedly and strongly criticised by the European Court of Human Rights. Obviously, it was in flagrant breach of the European Convention, Article 6.1. Now, the next point, of course, was that judges and prosecutors were part of the same judicial association. They went through the same process before arriving at their professional entry into the profession. They frequently changed position from judge to prosecutor and vice versa as they wished. The European Convention had been signed in Rome in November of 1950, and the signatories included Great Britain, France and Italy. And the principal relevant provisions were Article 6, which required a fair trial within a reasonable time, and Article 7, the principle of legality: no one shall be held guilty of any criminal offence on account of any act or omission which did not constitute a criminal offence at the time when it was committed. Now, a common lawyer, having heard the foregoing description of Italian criminal procedure, might have been surprised that Italy even bothered to sign the European Convention, because to a common lawyer, the Italian criminal procedure would seem not to provide much of a fair hearing to the accused, nor an independent and impartial tribunal. The tribunal came to the trial with the dossier of all the secretly obtained material obtained by the investigative judge. No hearing within a reasonable time, not much of an entitlement on the part of the person charged to defend himself or to examine the witnesses against him. But it must be remembered, when saying that, that the Italian investigating judges were required to approach the matter as an impartial investigator, searching for truth and accuracy, and if there were exculpatory factors, to bring those out as well. Of course, if reaching the conclusion that there had been no offence by the suspect, then to say so and not to charge. And one might also add that, having made these rather derogatory comments of the Italian system, so far as breaches of Articles 6 and 7 of the Convention is concerned, the United Kingdom is responsible for virtually as many allegations of breach of the Convention as any other of the signatories to it. Now, this was followed then in 1988 by the Italian Parliament deciding dramatically to change its inquisitorial system and move towards an adversarial system. The principal reasons for this were, quote, "sophisticated Italian public opinion was profoundly dissatisfied with a machinery of justice that was, on one hand, perceived as unable to fully protect the defendant's right to a fair trial, and on the other hand, as excruciatingly slow," unquote. And what the Parliament attempted to achieve was to graft a number of features of the adversarial process onto a non-adversary inquisitorial base. And this involved separating the investigative and judicial functions at the first stage, limiting the extent to which the material obtained by the investigating judge could be used in court, and largely preventing out-of-court hearsay matter from being used at trial. And the evident purposes, obviously, were to enable the accused to confront the witnesses and the evidence, and to prevent the trial judge having his or her mind prejudiced by reference to the material contained in the dossier. The effect of these reforms was dramatically to reduce the power and influence of the judges and prosecutors, and to produce intentionally a much fairer trial. And inevitably, it was seen by the judiciary as a quite traumatic departure from the past. And it so happened that 1992 was also the year in which prosecutors Falcone and Borsellino and their bodyguards were murdered by the mafia. The judiciary regarded these attempts to introduce something like a common law adversarial system into Italy as a serious mistake. They took the view that the common law system was much less efficient, very costly, and more productive of delay, and one might add, the defendants got off occasionally. Now, the Italian judiciary also placed a very high value on the search for truth during the investigation. They didn't accept at all that they could be regarded as partial, and consequently, in 1992, the year of the assassinations, the Italian Constitutional Court, in three separate decisions, ruled that the 1988 changes were unconstitutional, which effectively neutered the attempt to bring about those changes. There followed an unseemly dispute between Parliament and the courts, which ultimately led, in 1999, to the amendment of the Italian Constitution by Parliament passing by a supermajority the necessary changes to bring about the changes it had sought to bring in 1988. And that has effectively now brought about a much more adversarial system. France, too, is moving away from the old inquisitorial system, chiefly in consequence of the Outreau child abuse scandal of 2000, when a young and inexperienced magistrate in Outreau in the Pas-de-Calais had 18 defendants held in custody for 1 to 3 years and their children separated from them in that time. Their detention and later first convictions were principally based on the testimony of one prosecution witness, a woman who later admitted that she'd lied, and the innocent suspects thus spent years in jail on remand, and one of them committed suicide. And the revelation that the principal witness had lied, and therefore of the innocence of most of the accused, led to national outrage in France. The magistrate was reprimanded, the Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin and President Chirac both apologised to the defendants, and all of this was widely characterised as a judicial catastrophe. The magistrate had accepted perjured evidence and other evidence from teachers, social workers and psychiatrists, which was found to be biased and lacking in weight. And 13 of the 18 were finally acquitted, and the chief Parisian prosecutor turned up at their second trial on the last day, and even before it was finished and the verdict was announced, apologised to the defendants on behalf of the legal system. Now, the result was that a move was led by President Sarkozy, starting in 2005, when he was Minister for the Interior, to abolish the position of juge d'instruction, and leading to the running of criminal investigations by state prosecutors, supervised by an independent judge, giving much more weight to the presumption of innocence and the ability of defendants and their counsel to confront the prosecutor's case. These reforms are at this day now still in front of the French Parliament, as you would expect, vigorously opposed by the French judiciary. Now, I turn to the Victorian Charter and to the extent to which it may be assisted by decisions on the European Convention. And at the outset, I should say that on the 14th of April, our Attorney General spoke on the Charter at the Windsor Hotel and in the course of his address said that there was no right in the Charter that was new or not found already in existing law. According to the Australian of 30th October, he also recently said that, quote, all the Charter really says is that if any government wants to remove or vary a basic right of a Victorian citizen, you have to explain why you're doing it, unquote. Well, now, these comments may well have been made to calm the fears of contributors to the Australian, although they are more likely to draw from that source The riposte, then, why is it necessary to have a charter at all? Well, it is certainly true that much of sections 24 and 25, guaranteeing a fair hearing, do much the same as our High Court would say is guaranteed in our common law system of criminal law going back to Magna Carta. For if a trial is found to be unfair, that would in most, although not all cases, lead an appellate court to say that there'd been a miscarriage of justice requiring a new trial. But I think that there is more to it than that. Now, section 24 of the Charter requires a person charged with a criminal offence to be tried by a competent, independent and impartial court or tribunal. Now, so far as independent is concerned, I need only say that one writer has said that in order to be fully independent, it's necessary to examine the salary paid to judges, and that it's essential that judges are paid at the very least a salary which allows them to maintain a certain standard of living. I should add that that was said in relation to the application by the state of Georgia to become part of Europe and a signatory to the convention, and it being said that in Georgia the judges were paid only $20 a month and that most of them were forced to accept bribes in order to be able to live. As to the term of office necessary to ensure independence, the European Court has disappointingly said that as little as 3 years for a term of office is sufficient to decide that there is independence, which I must say it seems disappointingly low. Now, as to impartiality, I don't want to say anything about judges because I'm sure don't need assistance in working out what is partiality so far as a judge is concerned. But the cases are interesting in the extent to which the European Court has been prepared to deal with whether bias has been found to exist in a jury. And there are a number of cases that are helpful. In Remly in France, for example, the accused was an Algerian. The judge was sent a note by one juror saying that another juror had said during a break, "What's more, I'm a racist." And the French court said that it could not take formal note of this because the statement had not been made in its presence. On appeal, the European Court found there to have been a violation of Article 6 of the Convention on the ground that the court had failed properly to examine Mrs. M's allegation. In another case, Gregory, all of these are footnoted in the paper if you want to find them later. In Gregory, while the jury was deliberating on a criminal charge, the judge received a note saying, quote, "Jury showing racial overtones, one member to be excused." The judge gave an emphatic direction to the jury, and defence counsel didn't press strongly for a new trial. And the European Court then found that enough had been done by the trial court, and that therefore there'd been no violation of Article 6. But in a later case, Sander, two Asians were charged with conspiracy to defraud, and after the summing up, a juror sent a strongly worded note to the judge saying that at least two members had been making openly racist jokes and expressed a concern that the accused would be unfairly convicted because they were Asian. The judge then admonished the jury, but later was given a letter signed by them all, which utterly refuted the allegation of bias and assured the judge that they intended to reach a verdict solely according to the evidence. And one of the two Asians was convicted. Now, the European Court, taking a stronger view than had been the case in the previous matter of Gregory, said that little credibility could be attached to the letter affirming the absence of bias, that the judge should have reacted more firmly than merely seeking vague assurances, and concluded that the accused would have been entitled to have had misgivings about the jury's impartiality. Now, this creates a serious problem if the same view is taken in Australia because of the very fixed rules in the common law about jury secrecy. And inevitably in the state, jurors are very firmly warned about having prejudices in a case that might have racial overtones, and warned that if they have any, they must not take part as jurors in the trial. But it's not uncommon for suspicions to exist that jurors have not been truly impartial. A good example, most people would say, is the Lindy Chamberlain trial, where a Northern Territory jury convicted her in circumstances where many people took the view that there was ample evidence, at least to throw a doubt, if not to demonstrate positively, her innocence, a strong prejudice existing on the part of most people in the Northern Territory, still held by many, that she was as guilty as sin. There is a very interesting and useful article on this subject by Katie Quinn, entitled Jury Bias and the European Convention in the Criminal Law Review of 2004. There have been a number of cases since. They've reached the House of Lords, and what they demonstrate is that there is a significant difference in dealing with jury bias depending upon whether the allegation of bias is made before the jury verdict or whether it is made afterwards, the House of Lords taking the view that rules as to jury secrecy, making it very much more difficult to examine the question without positively embarking on what is in effect an attempt to discuss how the jury embarked on their discussions. One case that did result in a successful challenge was where a number of jurors in a murder case met in their hotel room during a break and attempted to use a Ouija board to contact the victim and ask him who the perpetrator was. Now, the very real question for a judge confronted with an allegation of this kind is how far the judge can go in questioning members of the jury. Can the judge, for example, take affidavits from all members of the jury? Certainly Lord Hobhouse the House of Lords in a case called Connor and Mercer said that jurors, when empaneled, should be told of their duty to notify the court clerk or judge in writing of any improprieties occurring during the hearing. Now, next, retrospectivity. Section 27 of the Victorian Charter is the one that deals with retrospectivity. It's firmly held by continental countries that the point of retrospectivity is that people should be able to know beforehand whether their actions on which they're about to embark are criminal or not. And they take a very dim view of the ability of the House of Lords and common law courts to broaden the area of operation of common law criminal offences, or for that matter, to remove retrospectively common law defences. Now, there is no bar at common law to the Victorian Parliament legislating retrospectively. That's demonstrated by the Polyukovich case, where the Hawke government legislated 50 years retrospectively in relation to what had happened in the Ukraine in the Second World War. But once the Charter became operative, then retrospective legislation became impossible for the Victorian Parliament, subject to an override. Now, Section 27 also operates on the activities of a court, because a court which, for example, removes a common law defence operating retrospectively is acting retrospectively contrary to the Charter. Article 7, which produces the retrospective provision in the European Convention, has caused difficulties in a number of areas, but the most striking of them is the case of Accor and France. Accor had been convicted of drug trafficking in October 1984 by the Lyon Criminal Court and sentenced to 3 years imprisonment. He was released in July 1986. At that time, the code provided that if a person had been sentenced for such a crime, And within 5 years of the expiry of that sentence, committed a further serious crime, then he could be sentenced to up to twice the maximum for that offence, the maximum for the offence in question then being 10 years. So, on one view, Akur ceased to be a potential recidivist in July 1991. Now, in March of 1994, a new provision of the code came into force which extended the 5 year period to 10, during which a person could be sentenced as a recidivist. And after that amendment, some 21 months later, December 1995, Akur committed another drug trafficking offence, and the court then, relying on the 1994 amendment, sentenced him to 12 years imprisonment, relying on the double maximum. Now, the European Court, by a 4-3 majority, said that this was a violation of Article 7, notwithstanding that the amending law had been in force for 21 months before his reoffending. they said that the amending legislation operated retrospectively by, in effect, restoring his status as a potential recidivist in 1994. Now, speedy trial. There's not at common law any right to a speedy trial, and that was decided in JAGO and the District Court of New South Wales. But the European Convention and our Charter do give a right to a fair hearing within a reasonable time. The obvious matters which bring this about include the prevention of oppressive pre-trial incarceration, the limiting of prejudice to the accused defence. But against the right to a hearing within a reasonable time is also the entitlement of the community to have people who've committed criminal offences tried for them. So courts are very reluctant indeed to say that trials should be permanently stayed simply because of delay in bringing a matter to trial. And the court in JAGO, the High Court, said that delay can usually be cured by a judge giving appropriately firm directions at the trial, and notwithstanding unfortunate delay and worry and things of that kind, the accused can be protected and still given a fair trial. Whether that could be said to be so in cases where, say, witnesses have died, or so much time has passed that witnesses' recollections are so vague that they are very open to damaging cross-examination, is a different question, and with which our court may have to deal in the future. So far, the applications that have been made in relation to delay have usually related to matters such as delay, they've not been very successful. I doubt that the Charter's provisions on delay will have very much impact beyond what the common law already provided. Next, the power to stay proceedings in the absence of legal aid. Now, since Dietrich's case, the courts have recognised a power to grant a stay in cases where representation of an indigent accused is essential to a fair trial of serious matter. Legal aid is now provided through Victoria Legal Aid under the Act. There are criteria for eligibility set out, and the Charter gives a right to legal aid, provided if the interests of justice require it, and apparently if he or she meets the eligibility criteria of Victoria Legal Aid. Now, one can readily imagine a long and important criminal case which people of substantial means would not be able to provide the costs of legal aid for the defence, and it will be an interesting question there whether, when the state is represented by a senior silk and junior, and let's say the defendant possibly facing a life sentence for the importation of drugs, is defended only by a raw junior in circumstances where people might very well say that there was an inequality of arms, which is what the European Convention says a fair trial is there to guarantee. And the classic case under the European Convention is Steele and Morris against the United Kingdom, where two Greenpeace campaigners sent out a marvellously defamatory leaflet about McDonald's, resulting in a defamation action which McDonald's, above all, must very much regret they ever brought, which lasted for 313 days and said to be the longest in legal history, and in which the McDonald's were represented by a very experienced Silken Jr. and a team from one of the large London firms, and the defendants represented themselves, and the European Court found that the denial of legal aid deprived them of the opportunity to present their case effectively and contributed to an unacceptable inequality of arms between them. What then if the defence is incompetently conducted? And this may, of course, have caused the trial to be unfair. In common law countries, it's very difficult to rely on the fact that you've had a bad or incompetent counsel. Usually, you are bound by the conduct of your counsel, and only if it can be shown that the accused has suffered injustice because of flagrantly incompetent advocacy, can a retrial be required. The conduct of terrorism cases raises a number of questions which require consideration of the Charter. One of the most significant questions is the use of anonymous witnesses, resulting from a legitimate fear of reprisals or the necessity of keeping secret the identity of an informant. And there are now a number of cases under the European Convention where the normal rule under the Convention is that all evidence against an accused must be produced in the presence of the accused at a public hearing with a view to adversarial argument. But there are exceptions to this, and some of the cases involve intimidating accused who have threatened serious reprisals against witnesses. A difference is shown in the cases depending upon whether the witnesses are police officers seeking anonymity. It's very difficult for them to be given it. Civilian witnesses, on the other hand, who are justifiably, in the view of the judge, shown to be in legitimate fear of reprisal, are more likely to be permitted complete anonymity. I've set the cases out in the paper. Two of them, the cases of Dawson and Van Mechelen, both contain statements which require the interests of prosecution witnesses not to be unjustifiably imperiled and to be balanced against the interests of the defence. This will provide a further argument to prosecutors to object to cross-examination of a victim or witness when questioning becomes unfairly oppressive or lengthy. The European Court has said that fair trial in Article 6 has as one feature the equality of arms, a fair balance between the parties, and then to that should be added that those who practice in criminal law who have not read it should tonight read the case of Libke and the Queen from Justice Hayden, which contains a splendid exposition of how a judge can stop offensive questioning and can control unreasonable cross-examination. There's a most illuminating article by Justice Peter Johnson in the New South Wales Judicial Officers Bulletin on the subject of controlling unreasonable cross-examination. Various states have enacted, or apparently contemplate enacting, the anti-biking legislation, and there are many complaints about this type of legislation. It seems to introduce guilt by association, where no specific criminal act or omission has occurred or even been contemplated. All you need to establish is that a particular group is in the eyes of the usually the Attorney General, one who are likely to intimidate or commit criminal acts against the public. The group is then declared, and the anti-biking legislation then provides that those who meet frequently with members of the gang are guilty of an offence and may face a jail penalty for up to 5 years. That was a month ago in South Australia, held by the South Australian Full Court to be invalid. There are a number of charter avenues of complaint obviously available against this. Freedom of association is only one of them, but the provisions as to fair hearing and rights in criminal proceedings obviously raise arguments, another one of which would be the retrospectivity argument in section 27. One purpose of the principle of legality, as it's called, is to achieve certainty in the law. And when personal freedom is at stake, the citizen must know in advance what's lawful and what is not. Absent certainty in the law, it becomes impossible to know when one is acting in a manner which makes the act criminal. Now, just in conclusion, the Victorian courts are already building a substantial volume of case law on the Charter, although much of what I've been saying is, of course, speculation. I've set out in my paper the cases which have been dealt with in the Victorian courts. One thing that I should say is that one risk for counsel raising a charter point in criminal proceedings is that they are then required to notify the Attorney General and the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission that they propose to do so. The result may then be that both the Attorney General and the Commission appear in the matter, with the result that a good appeal becomes derailed by the arguments of those additional parties. And several counsel have said to me that if they see a Victorian charter point arising anywhere, they immediately submerge it and don't mention it to anyone. I note the comments of the former chairman of the bar, John Digby, that the charter is now very much part of the legal landscape and recording the bar's support for the charter. It's quite obvious that every part of the legal community, law schools, solicitors, legal aid lawyers, the bar and the judges, have all striven to master the workings of the charter and have done so very effectively. I should mention the practitioner's guide to the charter prepared by Brian Walters, SC, and Simon McGregor for the bar's continuing legal education program, which I obtained a copy of and found most helpful. And I should thank also Patrick Tian for providing me with a comprehensive folder of Victorian cases dealing with the Charter. And finally, also my thanks to Fiona Ransom for her excellent assistance in legal research for this lecture.
Before I thank the speaker, the time has come to field questions by him. So has anybody in the audience got questions or comments or observations made on the topic? Yes. There's a microphone coming to you, so if you could speak into that.
Thank you. My question relates to Article 2 of the European Convention and Article 9 of the Victorian Charter. I understand that courts in Britain have interpreted Article 2 of the European Charter to require an independent investigation of fatal police shootings, and I was wondering if that's correct, firstly, and what impact that might have, if any, on how Article 9 of the Victorian Charter is interpreted. Thank you.
I think there are many human rights lawyers here. I have never classified myself as a human rights lawyer. I'm simply someone who's been lecturing in crime and criminal procedure in an international context. I can look at about 10 people in the front row down here to whom I think you could better direct that question.
That's a good way of getting out of it. Yes. No, yes, you. No, no, you.
I was very interested, Justice Charles, in your description of how the Italian judiciary had to be dragged into a system where there were more rights for a defendant. And they said it would be too costly and would be inefficient. At the moment, a number of Victorian judges who are members of Victoria's parole boards have managed to convince the Attorney General to exempt the parole boards from the charter, saying that it would be too costly and inefficient to give rights to offenders. And in that regard, Australia actually gives far fewer rights to parole board people than to parole board subjects than England, New Zealand, Canada. And Victoria's at the extreme. It gives no rights to offenders, to fair hearings, to know what evidence is against them, even to a decision. I was wondering if you see any lessons from the Italian experience for the Victorian judiciary and the Attorney General on the question of whether parole boards should get on board the charter.
I haven't seen any particular advantage to be gained from that. The Italian system is so different from ours that I doubt very much whether there is assistance to be gained. There is the way in which trials are dealt with now in Italy is completely different. Since the changes brought into effect at the start of the year 2000, in an attempt to get away from the appalling delays of the past, they've brought in an abbreviated procedure which enables a case to be decided in the day following the crime. I've actually seen that happen in an Italian court. They've introduced plea bargaining on a grand scale and matters of that kind designed to try and reform and speed the process. So far as parole is concerned, I don't think we've got very much to gain from that. Certainly, when I was a judge, I had nothing but admiration for the way the parole system worked. We, in Victoria, at that time, which finished in 2006, had the lowest rate of incarceration for any Australian state and, at the same time, also the lowest rate of recidivism, which we sought to keep particularly the young out of jail as far as possible. And we sought to keep sentences as short as reasonably possible, meeting at the same time hot opposition from groups in the community, the Sun Herald, the Victims Assistance League, and matters of that kind. But it seemed to me that always the proof of the pudding was very much in the eating.
Thank you. Yes, the lady over there.
Thanks very much for that talk. I was going to start by saying it's terrific to actually hear someone talking about the Charter and the criminal law, and I should say that I'm Helen Zoki from the Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission, so we're the meddlesome intervener. So you may already have asked the question that I wanted to ask. We've been a bit surprised about the slow uptake of Charter or human rights issues by the criminal bar and beyond, you know, a concern that a matter might be derailed or, you know, however else it's typified. Do you have any other observations about why that might be the case?
Well, I think at first it took a while for the legal profession to become awake to the various points that might be raised. I do think that a lot of what is in the Victorian Charter and in the European Convention provisions is already involved in our concept of a fair trial. And what I was talking about with the members of the criminal bar with whom I've spoken is frequently they think that they've got a good point, and if they raise the Charter, the good point will be obscured. There'll be other interveners coming in and wanting to argue the higher points of law about the Charter, and their good point will get lost. So there certainly is that feeling among some members of the bar I know. There are also the folder of cases that I was given is a very substantial one, and a lot of people are now raising it, particularly in relation to matters of delay.
Yes, Yes, any other questions? Yes.
If I could follow up Helen's question in relation to pre-trial detention, in other words, remand, and post-sentence detention, and the procedures that we have operative in Victoria seem blatantly to be in breach of the Victorian Charter of Human Rights by having the capacity for post-sentence detention of periods of up to 15 years for fear of what someone might do in the future, and the conditions that have been raised in individual court cases recently of pre-trial detention, conditions in which people are in solitary isolation for months and shackled when left out of their cells for 1 hour exercise a day. Surely the Victorian Bar, not through individual trials, but through negotiation, would be an appropriate body to raise these matters with the Attorney General.
Oh, yes. I agree entirely, and certainly where people are going to be in remand for a long period beforehand, there will frequently be a very good argument that if the period of delay is long enough, then there is now, I think, a much stronger case for saying that people should be granted bail. In the case that went to the High Court, the case was Tilley. Justice Hayne made some very pointed remarks about delay in the court below and said he would order a speedy hearing of the application to the High Court. In relation to incarceration after sentence, that is a very live point, I entirely agree, under the Charter. We used to have, before the Charter, cases of indefinite detention, which raised again the question whether that sort of thing was permissible under our constitution, and whether judges making orders of that kind were being asked, in effect, to take part in an administrative decision. The cases were cases like Carr, Moffat, Davies, where ultimately it was found that these orders were acceptable, but certainly prolonged periods of detention after sentence, I think, are going to be very difficult to maintain. I agree.
Right, we have time for one more question. I'd like to ask a question. Is the experience in France and Italy now that the courts in the criminal context do not search for the truth, as is the case here, but rather try and ascertain what the facts were and what the legal responsibilities are?
No, I think they still are involved in the search for the truth. The truth and accuracy, and judges are not required to decide beyond reasonable doubt. Usually, the trial is not before a jury. It's before one or three judges. Sometimes, in the very serious cases, there would be a court of assize where there are two judges and, say, four jurors, in which case the judges and the jurors have to produce a verdict and have to give reasons. And judges in deciding have to give reasons for their decision in marked contradistinction to our juries. The judge is not required to decide beyond reasonable doubt. The judge has to arrive at a state of personal satisfaction that the verdict is correct. And it is on that basis that the decision is made.
Thank you. Well, I'd like, ladies and gentlemen, on your behalf to thank Stephen very much for the very informative paper that he gave today and taking us through the rather complex history in Europe, Italy and France in particular in relation to human rights, and also referring to our own position in relation to human rights, absent the Charter and with the Charter. I must say, having read his paper and having listened to him again in relation to it, I found it fascinating, but I did come to one conclusion: if I was ever starting at the bar again, the last thing I want to do is be a defence counsel in Italy. But I thank you also for coming tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for participating in the questioning. I think that the Victorian position is one where we can obviously learn from the European experience, and you've highlighted the fact that the Charter has potential application. It hasn't really rocketed away as some people thought it would. But it always reminds me of a a situation where when you're driving the car, there's always a policeman's blue light behind you. It really has an enormous effect, I think, not so much on the judiciary in the higher levels, but on some of the bureaucracy. I always remember Lord Denning published a little booklet for the public service with the public servant with a bowler hat, and sitting on his shoulder was a judge, so that he knew he was under constant observation. And so here, I think the Charter performs that role, and I think you've made that clear, Stephen. And on behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, will you join me in thanking him again?